It seems like people are still pushing boundaries the way they have historically. They just don't get rewarded the same way as they used to, and they get copied. And we see this within the IP community, but we also see this between countries, where we do have countries that essentially steal IP left and right.
Hello, I'm Bruce Berman, the host of Understanding IP Matters, a podcast series that looks at the impact of intellectual property rights on people and business. Season 3 spotlights such topics as artificial intelligence, IP licensing, and TikTok as a learning tool. Enjoy the episode. A decade ago, sharing invention rights through patent licenses was a lucrative field for businesses of all sizes. Patent licensing was generally seen as a win-win. Today, the patent world is much more contentious. Licensing inventions and technology has become a battlefield fraught with long and expensive lawsuits. Contributing factors include changes in the law, inventions that no longer are covered by patents, and the high cost of litigation. Today's guests have been among the most prolific licensing executives, having served two giants in the field, Microsoft and IBM. Both have achieved hundreds of mutually beneficial deals without resorting to lawsuits. They're here to share what has changed and how that might impact innovation and business. Our first guest is Louis Carboneau. He is an expert on generating return on invention rights. He heads the patent brokerage firm Tangible IP and is the former general manager of IP licensing at Microsoft. Mr. Carboneau is a venture partner and strategic advisor to Cycle Capital Management, an early stage clean tech venture capital firm with $300 million under management. He is himself an inventor and holds U.S. international patents associated with multimedia technology. William LaFontaine is a recognized leader in the areas of technology, licensing, partnerships, and intellectual property. He retired from IBM recently after a 33-year career, serving most recently as general manager of IP and vice president for research, business, and development. At IBM, Dr. LaFontaine and his team work with research business units and clients to accelerate market introduction of new technologies, including artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and healthcare. Dr. LaFontaine was responsible for delivering annually over $1 billion in technology transfer, joint development, and patent licensing. Welcome, Louis and Bill. Thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Louis, I think, are you in Quebec or are you in Seattle today?
Today I'm in Seattle, yes.
Seattle, okay. And Bill, you're up in...
I'm in Ithaca, New York.
Now, Louis, I know you're a French-Canadian, right?
Yeah. Our ancestors came in 1660 to Quebec City, so...
Wow. But Bill LaFontaine, that's a French name too. Are you also of Quebecois extraction?
My father was from there, but he didn't transfer the ability to speak the language to me.
Okay.
As long as you got the taste for good food, you're okay.
How is it different licensing patents for a company like Microsoft or IBM? Louis, let's start with you.
Well, you mean like 15 years ago versus nowadays?
Yeah. In general, you know, coming from a base of 40,000 or more patents, it's a different mindset for licensing one great patent. How would you say it differs?
When I was involved in it, we had, I would say, kind of two or three types of different licensing programs. There was the carrot licensing approach, where we have, you know, just as Bill at IBM, we have a lot of great technologies coming out of our research labs and incubation groups that did not necessarily make it to the product line, or sometimes could make it to the product, but also had some, you know, additional field of use, you know, scenarios where it could be deployed. You know, like the famous flight simulator engine was a good example, where obviously it was a product of Microsoft that was extremely popular, but the engine itself, the simulation engine, could be licensed in other verticals, which we did. At that time, I would say it was a very different outlook. People were embracing licensing or cross-patent licensing when they were, you know, it was two large companies, and Microsoft and IBM, I think it's publicly known, did a lot of cross-patent licensing agreements over the years. The only thing that would change as Microsoft was building its portfolio would be the size of the check that we had to sign to IBM. But I would say it was quite different. The only time we had issues, or we would encounter difficulties licensing was when we approach someone and we say, out of the blue, a small company, and we'd say, hey, we have this great technology, we have patents, we'd like to see if you're interested in licensing. I mean, I had the ungrateful task of doing this so many times where people would just, you know, hang up on me because they thought we were about to sue them.
Well, licensing could be a win-win. It was often a win-win, not necessarily contentious. Bill, what's your experience, working with a giant like IBM? And that's changed quite a bit over the years.
If I think back, call it 20 years ago, the big difference is we had a major semiconductor business that mainly for ourselves internally. So we developed a lot of technologies internally that happened to be at the leading edge that we would then go talk to other semiconductor companies. And the conversations were pretty straightforward. It said, look, you're using silicides, you're using copper. Here's examples of what you're building. Here's our patents. We can show it to them. Very easy to see. The conversations, pretty fact-based. And then there was also another set of clients, mainly in the IT space, that we had been partnering and licensing for decades. So we would go back and forth. There'd be people we had been licensing for 10, 20 years. And so you had this kind of foundation. I think the one thing that's changed for both Microsoft and IBM over time is the market consolidation. Whereas there used to be, 20, 30 computer companies, now there's like 4 or 5. You think about e-commerce, you think about software, that whole big layer of mid-sized companies doesn't exist anymore. So one big change is the universe got smaller.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, and IBM almost never sued anyone. In recent years, they sued a few folks, Groupon, I believe, but they did hundreds of licenses without suing folks. And that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we, one of the first we had to sue was Amazon, which was a case that we were able to resolve with them, a matter of months. Now it's a matter of years. And we've had to litigate a lot more than we would have liked. Because I think also the personalities on the other side of the table and who's influencing them makes a big difference. When it came to a Microsoft or a Japanese company or a big other, they understood IP. They understood patents. They understood the value of them. And like Louis said, many of these companies were building portfolios along the same way. So, but now we're talking to people who basically either don't believe in IP or they just don't believe in patents. They say, well, all of this stuff is for everybody to use and the like.
Well, if they're internet software or e-commerce companies, even if they're unicorns, $1 billion market cap or larger, they may have very few or no patents.
Yeah. And I think what's changed, and I would echo what Bill said. I agree wholeheartedly with what he said. It's people don't believe in patents. They don't believe that they should pay for stuff. I think is more the way I see it. There's been a change ethically in the way people see intellectual property rights. And I think it started with internet where everything wants to be free, and it kind of made its way and percolated to the patent space, 10 years ago. And then unfortunately, with the AI and then some case law, we kind of let the companies that do not want to pay for IP get away with it through, changes in the legal landscape. So now the reflex is, I'm not going to pay anything. Sue me if you're not happy, as opposed to let's engage. We respect, IP. And funny thing, or the ironic thing, is that the worst culprits here are people who actually own dozens and tens of thousands of patents. When it comes to their patents, obviously they want them to be respected. But when it comes to other people's patents, they couldn't care less.
That's an irony, Louis, that I think even bright people, investors and others, don't get, that a company who is the most active, efficient infringers, if you will, have sometimes tens of thousands of patents, but they just don't want to pay for other people's patents. What are some of the other ways? I mean, out-licensing, obviously, people love out-licensing because it's high margin, can get your arms around it. Investors understand it, the C-level folks understand it, but it's not the only way to generate a return on patents or other IP. What are some of the other ways to generate a return?
Well, let me take that one and I'll hand over to Louis. From an IBM perspective, the patents are the core of the revenue stream. They infuse everything you do. But the tech licensing side, whether it's just a tech license to some technology or know-how, trade secrets, and then there's the whole question of joint development or joint research engagements where you bring some technology, someone else brings some technology, and you can mutually work together for one of the two or both to optimize. So like in semiconductors, we partner with companies in Albany in a research center there. It's what we do with the state of New York. We have a pilot line there, and it solves multiple problems for us. It's how do we accelerate innovation? Because we want the leading edge for our big machines. Two is the cost of development's wicked high, and why should we not share that? Three is for many of the people we partner with, they have a different business model than us. So there's no conflict in how the IP gets deployed. And sometimes we're going to do something to accelerate a product offering of ours and work with somebody else to go, you know, test it. Or it's 1 + 1 = 3 and someone else will take it to market and we might get a royalty on their success. But this is all, you know, it sounds easy to do, much more difficult in practice to execute. And we've been at it for many decades. It takes a set of skills and relationships that are hard to replicate. But once you do them, like you said, it's another bite of the apple.
Louis?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, licensing IP is like, you know, getting tenants in a building you own. It's fairly well known, well delineated. Once you start adding technology, enabling technology, it's like more like selling a business. You have to have know-how to transfer. You have to have people to transfer sometimes or most of the time. It's a lot more complex, takes more time. So, you know, you don't do as many deals, obviously, than just straight licensing. As to other ways to monetize your IP, obviously, there's two that I can think of. When I was at Microsoft, we started this group called IP Ventures, I think we used to call this, and they were essentially mini spin-outs of research or incubation type technologies where we would package some technology, some IP, you know, patent portfolio that went with it, and would essentially approach VCs and get this funded, you know, help the VC, or the VC would help us find a good entrepreneur who would become the first CEO, unless we had an employee that wanted to be part of that. But researchers, I don't know about your experience, but researchers at Microsoft were probably not the best CEO candidate. So we'd try to find someone outside of the organization. So we did a few of those that actually did quite well. Some of them still exist or were later acquired. But again, it was very high touch. You know, it's hard to do that as a hobby, if you will, in the large organization where it's not the core business. Where I think we had more success, and IBM is the same, I'm sure, it's working around standards where, you know, you're using your IP as a huge leverage to make sure that, you know, your product line is going to be the one adopted by the industry as a whole. And I remember in the 1990s when we were trying to push this standard called Universal Plug and Play, and there was this other company called Intel trying to push this standard that they called Bluetooth. You know, at that time, none of them were known, and we were kind of in equal footing, and, you know, each one was trying to make its technology standard or standardized, and obviously we know who won, and it's not Microsoft, and now Intel is ubiquitous. Intel is, but the Bluetooth is ubiquitous. So that's a good example of using someone's IP to really develop a standard that essentially allows you to sell your products and guarantees that, you know, people will want that that technology for the foreseeable future.
I think that thing I would add to what Louis said is, for the audience, is the yield on these is not terribly high, and it takes a long time to develop. So you need a environment where you might put 20, 30 things out there, and you might get 2 or 3. Now, those 2 or 3 might last a long time. So it has the same venture kind of characteristics. I agree with Louis about the researchers. They love their technology, but the business savvy is usually not high on their list. And sometimes they can be blinded as to what the market really thinks of what they're doing.
I don't know about you, Bill, but at Microsoft, we would treat the researchers like academics. So basically, we would let them work with whatever they wanted to work with in their sandbox. There were a lot of projects that were solutions in search of a problem sometimes, or pet projects. And as a result, even internally, the tech transfer was very difficult. I remember seeing things develop that were really cool in the Beijing lab, for instance, of Microsoft. And they would finally make it to a product 4 versions later of Windows for Office, 8, 9, 10 years later sometime. And that's internal tech transfer. So you can imagine how hard external tech transfer can be.
There's been something of a sea change at both Microsoft and IBM with regard to open innovation. I think it was kind of instigated or catalyzed by the cloud. Before the cloud, there was less interest in open innovation. Bill, Red Hat certainly changed the culture and the way you did IP business at IBM.
I go farther back. I mean, IBM has been involved. You know, think about open platforms like Linux. You know, in on the ground floor, we were a founding member of Open Innovation Network. And so, you know, we completely believed in this notion that we could all go contribute some IP to build something that we could all then build differentiation on top of. And so we've done that piece. And then the relationship with Red Hat, you know, it was there for several years. And then when we adopted, you know, we acquired Red Hat, and we've kept Red Hat fairly independent of IBM to try to keep that piece going. But we've been, you know, working on open innovation, and we're also trying to get, you know, if people talk about open source, we're talking about inner source. How do we get people inside the firm to reuse code and other things that are created by others and basically replicate it? So openness on two dimensions. And the whole idea is market acceleration and market inputs. If you're contributing to a software standard and people are adding and critiquing, that's the best market insight you can get. Yeah, you're going to make less, quote, less money, but you're going to make money because you've got something better tested than you would if you tried to do it, you know, behind closed doors. And then, as Louis said, roll it out 5 to 8 years later.
And then you can sell services on top of it. Or
exactly.
I liken it to the razor blade and the razor. You know, you give the razor away and you sell the blades.
Yeah, for stuff it was a little bit different than Bill's experience. I think it was a younger company. So I would say the model was more open competition in the sense that sometimes we would ask 2 or 3 business units to come up with the same solution and pit them against one another and let the best one, you know, win. It was very Bill Gates-y in the approach, you know, very Darwinian. But at the same time, if it meant that the best solution came from a little startup unknown, you know, in Denmark, it didn't matter. You know, it was very, very, it was a meritocracy in terms of the technology in Bill Gates' eyes at that time. And, you know, he wouldn't mind them licensing or buying that company in Denmark if it had a better solution. So, and from that standpoint, it was kind of an open innovation approach, but more from a competitive standpoint.
Bill, you were responsible in your tenure for $1 billion in annual IP-related revenue. I think it was as high as 1.7 or 8 billion. How did that generally break down? I know patents were a big part of that mix, but it wasn't just patents.
No, we would monetize anything that had intellectual property associated with it. Source code licenses, tech licenses, joint development. So, you know, depending upon the year and what we were trying to partner and monetize, the majority could be those kind of licensing agreements, those partnership pieces. And you're right, there were years when they were very large. We thought of some interesting models how to monetize software that we had created and expose it to new markets. And that was pretty interesting. You could license the software, let somebody take it to market, and then take a small back end on the royalty piece. And in some cases, you would also say, look, I'll go buy back from you improvements to the software that you've created so I could go use it myself. So you had these flows going both directions that you were only limited by your creativity and how the accountants would treat things. I think one thing that was very interesting is it's a business where very hard to predict. You know, there's a steady state you can kind of do, but I would always say at the beginning of the year, I never knew where the money was going to come from. I knew kind of where and it's Louis's business got to be exactly the same, which is you start the year and say, I got to drive this, you know, millions or billions of dollars. And I have these things in my funnel, but I have no idea if and when and how much.
Louis?
Yeah, I had the same thing where we would start the year by being told where there's a hole in our budget of X hundred million dollars. Go make it up. What a way to set numbers for the year.
Yes, I think the one key for both of us that the audience should think about is you have to be both strategic and tactical at the same time. In other words, you're working on things, and I know Louis's business, he's working on things now that he's hoping they're going to generate income months or maybe a year or so from now, while he's still trying to go close deals and license patents and sell them at the same time. And so the people in the IP space have to kind of do both at exactly the same time, which is hard because you tend to swing one way or the other just by whatever energy level is going on at that time.
Louis, since I think 2011, you have headed Tangible IP. It's a patent brokerage and analytics firm. You're also a great analyst. Have a newsletter you put out, which is, I think, one of the best things that I read in intellectual property. So you're really at the leading edge, bleeding edge, if you will. Without violating any confidences, who are the patent sellers and buyers these days, and what are they looking for?
Buyers are looking for the perfect patent. And sellers are looking for the perfect buyers, and they rarely meet in the middle. You know, there's like ships passing each other at night because there's no such thing as a perfect patent. You know, as I alluded before, because of the legal environment having deteriorated when it comes to patent rights, it's fairly hard nowadays to find a patent that you can guarantee will be deemed valid after being challenged and will be deemed infringed after you've basically went through the gauntlet of challenges that are available to defendants, whether it's the PTAB or in court. Add to this that where you litigate your, dispute is going to make a big difference, whether it's in Texas or Northern District of California. The buyers, as a result, these days, you don't have a lot of operating companies that are interested in buying patents. I would say if I look at our own transactions for the last 2-3 years, I would say probably 80 to 90% of our buyers are non-practicing entities, and they're essentially buying the assertion value of the portfolio. You'd think it would be a smart thing for unicorns or startups, but eventually, essentially, like, for instance, the AI-based companies who have received hundreds of millions in investment and have, in some cases, absolutely no patents whatsoever, you would think it would behoove them to go around and look at what they can build overnight instead of starting organically and take 10 years to build, just a very small portfolio. And there are patents for sale in that space, but they don't seem to believe that it's important for them. And in the software space, where people, move very fast, where companies are being acquired very quickly, you don't really have time to build and deploy an IP strategy by building a portfolio organically and let it mature. So as a result, investors don't believe that patents are that important. And they send that message to their executives in these companies. So as a result, we don't see a lot of smaller companies buy patents where probably they should. And the large ones are currently sitting on tens of thousands of patents themselves, and their budgets are being slashed. So the last thing they have is authority to buy new patents, when they're having a hard time just maintaining the ones they have. What's left, it's mostly non-practicing entities who want to monetize the assertion value of those portfolios. And that has changed over the years. It used to be different.
Bill, what's your take?
Well, I don't disagree with Louis, but I do think we've been fortunate to close some licenses with companies that have included some patents for the very reason Louis said why they should do it. I think the challenge for these companies, they don't know Louis exists. And B, they don't really know what they think they need. And they need someone to come in and say, look, I have this portfolio of this, and you need a license. And oh, by the way, I can provide you some patents in your space that can help kind of augment the fact you have none. But that's a very narrow set of companies who could go do that. Microsoft could do it. There are people who could do that. But it also requires an investment on that. So I think Louis said something very important is everybody's getting tremendous pressure because patents have been hammered so hard by courts and elsewhere. You know, the CFO says, why do I bother? And if you don't bother, then you're not going to have the people who could actually help you sell them because you can say, hey, you need this technology. And I have this these patents that are in that space that I don't need that I can let you have for the right price that could be, take care of you. And so there's a knowledge gap. And that's, I think, why Louis has been so important to the industry is there's a knowledge gap out there in terms of who's got what, why should somebody care, and who should really want it. I think the other piece is just how this all gets financed is also changing things dramatically.
What does this mean for innovation? Because that's sort of my net. Is, you know, is this net positive for innovation, this change, or is it net negative? I would, from my perspective, it looks negative.
Well, I would agree with you. What do you think, Louis?
Yeah, I agree. It's a net negative. At the same time, I'm always amazed by the fact that I think there's a human urge to innovate that will remain regardless of the legal or factual environment where people just want to innovate, even if it's not always in the interest to do so because they're going to be ripped off, you know, fairly quickly. I think it's just part of the human DNA to wanting to innovate. So even if the environment is negative, which I agree it is, it seems like people are still, you know, pushing boundaries the way they have historically. They just don't get rewarded the same way as they used to, and they get copied. And we see this within the IP community, but we also see this between countries where we do have countries that essentially steal IP left and right. It has not so far forced the companies that innovate to stop innovating because they feel like, you know, it's become a sucker's game. We might get there. I hope we won't.
The one thing I would say, Louis, there are two, to me, there are two types of technology areas where patents are going to still be very real. Think about quantum. We're talking about leading innovations, like what we did 30 years ago in e-commerce, that the things that people invent today in quantum, people will use for decades. They'll be foundational. Then there's other stuff that's just purely incremental, that the value is sort of diminutivist because, oh yeah, you've improved something a little bit, but I have 1,000 other patents in that area. So the real value. So I'm hoping that, you know, in the areas of, you know, the quantum and certain types of, you know, brain-inspired microprocessors and in security, that, you know, there's some real innovation still to be done. And I'm hoping people will protect it because, you know, those will be things that will be foundational for decades to come.
I agree. I mean, the most, I think, important fundamental research that's coming out is still coming out of, you know, university and research labs. So in that sense, it's very often not protected by patents because most professors don't care. They just want to, you know, publish and be recognized by their peers. They don't believe in patents for other reasons, mostly ideological. So I agree with Bill, you know, these are fundamental innovations that, and they will happen. Whether they will be protected, I think, depends a little bit on where they originate.
But do the biggest tech companies in general, not talking about those you are associated with necessarily, do they really want disruptive innovation? They benefit from the incremental improvements because they have sort of a franchise and strong patents are a threat. I think IBM had the confidence over the decades that its R&D would always be at the leading edge. It would always take it to the leading edge.
Well, I think another piece to that is when you have a near-death experience and nearly go bankrupt because you missed a technology shift, then you and we still have people from, you know, the early 90s still at the helm. You're right. There's a lot of people who have an investment. They don't embrace it. But if you don't embrace it, you know, there's plenty of companies who had a great franchise till they didn't have one. And you really can't predict the future terribly well. So, and I think that's the short-sightedness of industry, you know, certain, you know, leadership roles where an important patent might be a decade in the making before all of a sudden it's something that really moves places. So you have this need for a quarterly return where the foundational pieces that might impact you could take a decade to get to.
Yeah. And I have a great anecdote to support what Bill just said. You know, when we would go, even after he stepped down as a CEO, Bill Gates was still in charge of all of our patent budget and approvals and all this. I mean, he's the best patent attorney in the world that never was a patent attorney. He understood the thing inside out.
He hired Marshall Phelps, right? Out of retirement.
He hired Marshall, and Marshall made quite an impact. I can tell you that, both at IBM and Microsoft. But Bill Gates, we would go and we'd ask for budget to file, let's say, 2,500 or 3,000 patents. And every year he would ask, you know, just show me the 10 that are really core to Microsoft that, you know, you would never let go of. And we always had a hard time because you don't know until you need them, right? That's the almost the nature of patents is, you know, they're barriers to entry. So you, maybe they've done their job by just deterring people from doing certain things. Sometimes you have to assert them. And the one time where we needed to assert 10 patents that we thought were absolutely bulletproof, I think 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 11, were declared invalid. So that was a big wake up call for us, in terms of, first, you never know where your good patents are, and the ones you think are really solid are not. And actually, it changed a lot of things. Some, you know, some heads rolled, and some, and we went from a quantitative to a qualitative approach to filing patents. And I think a lot of the industry players followed after that and reduced their patent filing and went with, you know, fewer but higher quality patents, which should be the norm, by the way. I mean, you don't patent every little incremental invention just because the inventor wants it, because you'll get a check or a cube or something or a plaque to show for it.
Does it matter, Louis, that value and patent transactions are not really accurately reflected on the balance sheet? IP is something that it's still thrown into goodwill. How much does that matter to value and to the respect for IP?
It does a lot, because if it were on the balance sheet, people would pay a lot more attention, starting with CFOs. The problem with patent valuation, as we know, it's a black art. You know, it's we used to use one finger in the wind to basically assess value. Now we use two fingers. That's as good as we've become over the years. But I mean, we value patents all the time. And the difference between the report you hand out to the client with all these models based on income and all that and projections and the market reality are striking. You'll never get the amount or even close to the amount that you value the patents at if you have to sell them now, which is very different from real estate, where both should be pretty similar, right? So until we can crack that nut, I think it's going to be hard to recognize that on the balance sheet, because nobody will agree with the value.
And there are people like IPWee who are trying to tackle this problem, you know, and we'll see where that plays out, because in certain markets like Japan, valuing IP is becoming more and more of an important issue for them. But I agree with Louis. It's like you put your finger in the air and see which way the wind blows. But another way to translate value is cost avoidance. So I always tried, when somebody big got sued by somebody that I had a license to, I could point to the CFO, see what happened to this company. We're good because we have a license to it. And so it's always hard to show what avoidance is, but there are some statistics. I mean, there's some certain companies you cannot compare yourself to Apple or Samsung. You just can't, because they're so far to the far right on the spectrum of the number of cases given the size. But there are others in the IT and other spaces that you can compare yourself to, and you can do some figures of merit and say, let's say your competitor is getting sued 30 times this year and you're getting sued 5. Okay. You can do some average cost of litigation. You know, I mean, it's going to be a swag, and you can say a min and a max and say, look, I helped avoid $50 million in expenses here, and I spent maybe, you know, some multiple of that. That's what you have to do to try to show value, is that by taking a license, whether you got money or didn't. I think what people miss is the only people who really win in this are the outside counsel who provide services to either the licensee or the licensor. But people forget how much money that is, you know, and that's a big number. And quantifying the avoidance is a key element.
With regard to China, U.S., are we our own worst enemies when it comes to China? Because a lot of companies are there. They wanted to get there early. They wanted the market share. They wanted access. And they gave up a lot.
I do think the, you know, U.S. law regarding patents hasn't helped us. It's created an asymmetric field where in China, you can get an injunction. You can't get one in the U.S. I mean, so you can actually, as a third party company, go do this. Now, if you get judgments are small, but the fact you can get an injunction is pretty valuable, but it's completely asymmetric. So you can imagine a Chinese company suing, you know, somebody in the US, and the US company wants to fire back on the other side, and the what you can really do doesn't match up. So I think, you know, if you're going to go license technology, you have to make certain assumptions about, you know, are you ever going to see the royalties? Are you ever going to, so you have to work for that. But I do think the Chinese over time have been strengthening their IP systems. I'd be interested in what Louis thinks. It has gotten stronger, still not enough to dissuade people, but it's on the right trajectory. I just worry about us going the wrong direction compared to them.
There's a cultural aspect here, and then there's kind of a state-sponsored IP theft. So those are two different things. So 15, 20 years ago, the piracy rate for software in China was 99.5%. So essentially, nobody was paying. They were just replicating CDs, and that was kind of, you know, assumed. So we used to joke that we had a lot of users, but very few customers in China, because they were all using the software for free. There's no concept of private property there, at least under the communist regime historically. So people just didn't see this as an issue. So fast forward, there's been a lot of changes in China in terms of valuing IP and making sure people understand the value of IP. The problem is it has benefited, you know, Chinese companies more than foreign companies trying to invest. And as you mentioned, Bruce, rightly so, there was a quid pro quo where if you want to have access to the Chinese market, you have to open your kimono. And we saw this with car manufacturers, with plane manufacturers. And as a result, you know, China has closed a gap much more quickly than you would have expected otherwise. That was very smart of them. I mean, they played this game extremely well, and we don't always, because they're more patient and more deliberate in their attempt. So I'm fine with that. I think the two things I have a problem with is the organized IP theft, which is rampant and very often state-sponsored. And second is the fact that China played a very good hand in you know, building a expert IP tribunal, IP specialized courts, what have you over there, which frankly is great. And in the first few years, you know, they would kind of be an even playing field where they wouldn't necessarily, you know, favor the home team. Now, and again, that's more anecdotal, but I'm getting a sense from the conversation I've had with people that this is changing a little bit. You know, you're going to be fine asserting patents in China if it's either a foreign versus another foreign company, or Chinese versus another Chinese company. But if the plaintiff is a foreign company and the defendant is a Chinese company, you may not get the same treatment. And then, as Bill alluded, we're shooting ourselves in the foot here in the U.S. by creating all these weaknesses and loopholes in our system where, you know, I mean, follow the money. I mean, there's a lot of investments that used to be made in the U.S. that are being made elsewhere now, because people want to invest in companies that reside in a country where IP is treated seriously. And when you're starting to invest in China instead of the U.S. because of that, you know, you have a lot of work to do.
Final questions. What does the future look like for patent licensing and monetization? Bill, let's start with you.
Oh, I think we'll still be licensing. I think it's a little bit of a dance. Licensors will continue to try to find ways to not take a license. Licensees will find, you know, there are new mechanisms. You know, I think the whole area of litigation financing has opened up the ability for people to go do this. I think it will be less lucrative over time. I think the dollars people will get, netted dollars, will continue to go down. But and I think the big question is going to be, what new spaces will people be monetizing that we're not thinking of today? Because right now, and I think Louis sees it better than most, is there's certain core areas everybody's interested in. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, there will be new spaces that people will move into. And I think that's going to drive some of this. So we'll be 5 to 10 years from now, we'll be doing what we're doing today. It'll be, you know, kind of chasing people around the table. Each side will try to find new techniques to, you know, deflect and defend themselves. And hopefully there'll be some new space to work after.
Louis?
I totally agree with that. I think what we also see, and Bill mentioned the consolidation in the industry, I think we're seeing this the licensing level as well, where we have what I call retail licensing and wholesale licensing. The wholesalers, the Ericsson and Nokia of the world, will always be able to license their portfolio because they have enough critical mass and deep, you know, pockets, and, you know, people know that they're not going to go away. And we've seen this recently with Ericsson announcing pretty good results and some important licenses to large companies, or renewals thereof with Apple and others. And then retail licensing, I think, is where people are going to have a hard time because, you know, they don't have a lot of assets. They don't have deep pockets. They have to rely on third party financing to assert. And the implementers are just waiting them out and saying, you know, just sue us, and, you know, they'll put them through the grinder. And as long as the legal environment is helping them do this, it will be very difficult. So if we have some developments in the U.S. patent system that are, you know, positive, whether Congress, through Congress or new case law, things could change rapidly, the same way they change fairly rapidly. If you just think of it, you know, 10 years ago was a very different environment than 25 years ago. It was pretty bad. So you have those cycles. So there's always going to be some cyclical, you know, ups and downs in the patent system. So I agree with Bill. Licensing is there to stay because at some point, you know, you cannot use everything you create. So you have to, you know, let go of your excess inventory, and then you cannot create everything you need. So you have to import and you have to license in. So that's just a nature, and it's a basis of commerce with between two fishing villages, you know, 10,000 years ago was the same thing.
So many developments today and in the future will be software related. If the patentability of software continues to be as vague as it is currently, what do you see as the impact of that, Louis?
Well, people will essentially keep everything secret by putting things in the cloud behind a black box. They'll just, you know, try to protect themselves and create barriers to entry by creating ignorance instead of, you know, licensing rights and getting rewarded for that. So I think that we're already seeing this, where, you know, everything is in the cloud. And if you can build something and not reveal what it does or how it does it, that's what people are doing now. If patent rights were a bit stronger on the software side, I think we would probably see, especially smaller companies, embrace that a bit more. I think the large companies are still doing it, because they can play both sides of the game, but the smaller ones currently are staying on the sidelines when it comes to patenting their software inventions because they feel that there's no protection for them.
Bill?
Very simply, some of the software innovations are changing so dramatically that filing a patent is sort of useless because by the time the patent's granted, no one's practicing what you're doing. I think some of those areas will stabilize and people will go back to it, but I think there'll be a period of time in AI where some of it's just not going to be discoverable. You're not going to know if someone's practiced your invention. Or, you know, either A, is your invention useful 5 years from now, or if they're practicing it. So there'll be a bunch of that. But there'll be some other corrections. It'll become obvious for some pieces, but there'll be some pieces that'll be hidden.
Great. Well, thank you both very much. Understanding IP Matters is brought to you by the Center for IP Understanding, an independent nonprofit. Follow CIPU on LinkedIn at the Center for Intellectual Property. Content conveyed is for informational purposes only and does not represent the views of CIPU or its affiliates. This episode was produced by Jack Shields for Wild Creek Studios.